Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We shape our dwellings, and afterwards, our dwellings shape us. Winston Churchill said that in 1944, and it remains true today. As part of our station-wide series, The First Decade, we're looking at how the environmental and familial circumstances of a child's first 10 years can influence, even determine, their later lives. Today, housing, neighborhoods, and the built environment.
We know that poor health stems from your environment in many ways, and unfortunately, a lot of poor quality housing throughout the United States has been impacting health. And what we see is that it's primarily impacting young children and older seniors who are more susceptible to poor indoor air quality.
That's Jamie Blosser, founder of the Sustainable Native Communities Collaborative and associate at Atkin Olson Shade, echoing findings from a spate of recent studies that have quantified how childhood poverty, specifically living in a poor neighborhood, influences cognitive abilities, adult employment, earnings, and behavioral and health problems, including depression, asthma, diabetes, and heart disease, at higher than average rates. We reach Jamie Blosser and Kathy Dorgan, two prominent practitioners of community and public interest design, last week, just after they'd put together a panel on community-based design at the American Institute of Architects Conference in Atlanta. Here's Jamie talking about some of that panel's findings.
One of the data points is that 20 to 30% of asthma attacks are linked to home conditions that can be avoided. The other thing that we try to promote is activity. So it's not just indoor air quality. It's getting people to be outside more, to be walking around more. For instance, climbing 3 to 4 floors per day is associated with a reduced stroke risk of 29%. We're sort of on the tip of this sort of metrics that will change a lot of what we do.
Practitioners now use the term affordable housing to distinguish their work from the low-income housing units of the past. Those projects have mostly been torn down to establish more human-scale structures. Still, being raised in poor housing in a low-income area can directly affect a person's opportunities. Here's Kathy Dorgan, an architect and urban planner who employs participatory design practices, which she says can achieve communities of choice and justice.
There are so many examples of that. There's a recent study out of Harvard that really looked at where children live and what kind of opportunities come their way as a basis of where they live. And so, for example, if someone lived, perhaps one of your nephews, in New Hampshire in an average community, average opportunity, and they moved to Baltimore, which has recently been in the news, which is not an area of high opportunity, their long-term prospects for the household income would decrease for a boy by 1.39% for every year that they lived in Baltimore. And so the lifetime effect of that would be, if someone lived there their whole childhood, they might make a third of what they would make if they'd stayed in a community of average opportunity.
But that does not only happen in inner cities like Baltimore, says Jamie.
When we look at poverty, 85% of counties in the United States that are high poverty counties are non-metropolitan. So we know that rural poverty is a huge issue. And unfortunately, with more information and more data about location and how important location is in affordable housing and providing access to transit and employment and services, we know that rural regions are even more vulnerable because they are more remote and do not have that access. So we see higher costs of living, but we also see higher vulnerabilities, I think, without that access.
A study from the Urban Institute looking at low-income residents in Chicago and Portland found even preteen kids at risk of experiencing school failure, engaging in risky sexual activity, and suffering from poor mental health. While the numbers may sound bleak, not all low-income communities are dead ends. There are places known as opportunity-rich or high-opportunity communities, characterized by more stability and supervision for children, and better schools and access to transportation. Here's Kathy Dorgan.
High opportunities often are high-income communities, but they're not always. So we have a great variance between communities with similar income profiles and the amount of opportunity that they afford to the residents. And there's a lot of things that lead to that. A lot of it's trust. There's been a lot of studies of communities that work together better, trust each other, provide more opportunity for all of their residents, high or low income, communities with less segregation. But it's also a matter of public policy. And we've seen great examples in Massachusetts where they've moved to much higher performing schools in many low-income communities. And that's, of course, immediately made those higher opportunity communities. I live in Connecticut, where we have much more disparate and the highest in the nation difference in income in achievement between communities. So that difference in achievement in communities in Connecticut makes it a much worse place for a poorer person or anyone to live than our neighboring state of Massachusetts has addressed that by policy.
As practitioners of community and public interest design, Jamie Blosser and Kathy Dorgan aim to bridge that gap. Here's Kathy again.
So the important thing, I think, here is to provide every resident with opportunities and access to those opportunities. And there's a lot of ways to achieve that. And that may be by mixing incomes within a specific development. It may be by mixing incomes and opportunities and resources within a larger neighborhood. And so I think it's every community has important structures and resources for providing opportunity. And it's therefore important to do real design within communities to understand the existing conditions, to understand the opportunities there. Having said that, I think it's really important not to have large areas of segregated incomes and segregated opportunity.
Not segregating communities based on incomes or race, a lesson learned perhaps by the public housing fails of the post-war era. Think of those massive urban high-rises isolated on the outskirts of cities, places like the infamous Pruitt-Igoe housing project in St. Louis, built with great promise in 1956, only to be demolished in the mid-1970s, or the Robert Taylor homes in Chicago, widely considered to be a low point for American urban renewal. While it's easy enough to see those failures in hindsight, will today's designers make similar mistakes? Nadia Anderson is an associate professor of architecture and urban design at Iowa State University. I asked her about the public housing of the post-war era. What did those planners and architects get wrong?
One of the big issues is the move away from integrated neighborhoods that were smaller scale and had services, housing, small businesses, schools, all within walking distance of each other, to housing-only large concentrations of people without jobs, grocery stores, good transportation, anything like that nearby. And so the high-rise model basically follows that. Another issue was that a lot of the government housing, particularly in the United States, because of budget constraints, was made with not very good materials, often had issues with maintenance.
Mm-hmm. In what ways did the designs fail to serve the community? And I'm thinking specifically about children.
One of the things is obviously that the high rise, while it's an idea of a tower in a park, by moving people off of 1 to 3 stories where they have easy pedestrian access to the space of the street and the space of the outdoors. When you go to a 10, 20, 30-story building, you start to move people away from the ground, away from places for play and interaction that you get typically on a street or in a small pocket park in a more traditional neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. So there may have been greens and grounds and playgrounds in these places, but did people use them?
I think that really varies. I think over time, definitely not, particularly as safety issues started to mount, where you had elevators that weren't maintained and, you know, staircases that became dangerous to go up and down. And so, you know, people would only use them really when they had to. And the same is true now in a lot of neighborhoods that are struggling with poverty issues, where kids are kept indoors because of safety.
Well, Nadia, you specialize in public interest design. Now, what is that exactly?
Public interest design is really about designers working, not providing expert professional advice to a passive public, but it's really about partnership with public organizations, communities, nonprofits, government institutions that typically don't have access to traditional design services. And the engaged partnership with those communities is really critical because as professionals, we come in with certain technical and other design skills and knowledge, but the people who live in the places where we're hoping to work have knowledge of place, of history, and of what their community really needs. And so it's an equal partnership.
Sounds like it's not top-down, but involves the community. So how does that actually work? Do you meet with members of the community? How do you select them? How do decisions get made?
Well, we usually try to start at a more general level where we're trying to identify what are key issues within a community. And even if we're talking about a very specific, you know, product, let's say a plaza as part of a streetscape design, we'll talk as much about how people imagine themselves using the space and what they can envision happening there as we will about specific materials. And I think material kinds of decisions really come fairly late in the process, and they naturally tend to evolve out of the discussions that have preceded them.
One of the criticisms of housing projects, traditional housing projects that we've seen, is that they are unsightly, not an interesting place to live, I would say, outside of the projects that were destroyed in New Orleans. How important is beauty when it comes to affordable housing?
I think beauty is really important, and it gives people a sense of respect for themselves and for their own communities. Now, you know, everyone has a different definition of beauty, but one of the things that I've seen that's very important in designing affordable housing is that, you know, the place where someone lives represents who they are, what their community is, and what their values are. And that's one of the biggest contributions that I think well-designed buildings can make to a sense of identity for both individuals and communities.
Well, when we're looking at affordable housing, in what ways can good design help people cope with low-income lives or alleviate their financial strain or some of the concerns particular to them?
You know, I think there are some really simple things like having spaces that are well laid out. I remember one of the first projects that I worked on with students. There were complaints from residents that they couldn't watch their kids from the kitchen. So making sure that the kitchen opened into the living room so that everybody, you know, could be within eyeshot of each other and also be able to engage in conversation. Other things like making sure that money gets spent in the budget on good quality windows, building envelope insulation in order to make the buildings as energy efficient as possible really helps to reduce utility costs, which can be a really big part of housing costs.
Affordable housing is also a concern in rural areas. What should a designer consider when developing affordable housing in those kind of areas?
That is a really good question, and I have some experience with that, being from Iowa. One of the big challenges with affordable housing in rural areas is cost effectiveness, and it's very difficult when you're in a rural area where an old ramshackle house can be acquired for, say, $40,000, and a new construction is going to be $120,000 to ever get close to an affordable cost. The idea of rehabilitation of existing housing stock, I think, is one of the biggest challenges facing rural communities right now.
Well, Nadia Anderson, thank you for filling us in.
You're welcome.
Nadia Anderson, she's Associate Professor of Architecture and Urban Design at Iowa State University, and where she co-directs the university's Community Design Lab.